It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios, welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me, or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4 to 1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
October 1947. Two shiploads of Jewish refugees from Europe attempt to land in Palestine, only to be turned away by the British and shipped to internment on Cyprus. The British mandate in Palestine was about to end, however, and the United Nations was debating the partition of Palestine between the Jews and the Arabs as a solution to the turmoil in that country. In May of 1948, a new Jewish state, Israel, was born in a bath of blood. Jewish troops routed Arab forces from the city of Haifa in the first of a series of battles that were to reverberate through the years. In the year of independence, fighting was fierce in the Negev desert area. Here, Israeli troops routed the Arabs and took hundreds of prisoners. Meanwhile, on May 14th, 1948, the new government headed by David Ben-Gurion is installed in Tel Aviv. Thus, for the first time since the Roman Legion destroyed Jerusalem in the year 70 AD, the Jewish people have a nation of their own. United Nations teams accompany Israeli soldiers under the white flag to retrieve the bodies of soldiers killed in the continuing strife with Arab troops. The UN was able to effect some uneasy pacts calling for a truce, but skirmishes continued to break out. Dr. Chaim Weizmann joined Premier Ben-Gurion in the government. The Jewish patriot became president as Israel went before the United Nations to seek a place in that world body. The Middle Eastern Arabic nations were in violent opposition, and when Israel was voted a membership, they walked out in a body. For the rest of the day, their seats remained empty, but they returned the next morning to no further incident. Thus, history was made as the Jewish state of Israel was born. Conceived in strife and weaned on violence, Israel has flourished to become a constructive voice in world affairs. Her flag became a symbol of hope in a troubled world.
All right, Sandy Rios with you. You know, we used to get our news through those newsreels. Before television was really in every home, you'd go to the movie and you'd get your news. And that's a great example, telling the story of the beginnings of Israel. And that's really what we're going to talk about today. Just what is the truth about Israel? Are they usurpers who have moved into Palestinian territory and mistreated the Palestinian Arabs? Are they occupiers? Are they the reason that the Arabs are so violent and perpetrate extremism, terrorism on the Israelis? Are the Israelis the cause of that? Because that's what the common view that seems to be spreading as it once did, but now through college campuses, through schools, through the education system, and through certainly mass media. Our next guest has written a book called Reclaiming Israel's History, Roots, Rights, and the Struggle for Peace. This morning, David Brog joins me. He's the executive director of the Maccabee Task Force and the founding executive director of Christians United for Israel. David, thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Sandy. Really great to be with you.
You know, I just have to ask you personally, why in the world, of all the things, I looked at your resume because it's very impressive. You graduated from Princeton, Harvard Law School. You worked as a chief of staff for Senator Arlen Specter and staff director for the Senate Judiciary Committee. Those are huge achievements on anybody's resume, David. So why devote yourself to the conversation about Israel?
Well, for me, Israel is really the tip of the spear. Israel is a bastion of everything we hold dear as Americans. It is a democracy. It upholds the highest of our Judeo-Christian values. respect for human life, respect for religious freedom, respect for human dignity. And it does all of it in the midst of the very enemies that want to destroy both Israel and America. Israel is this frontline ally surrounded by radical Islam, under daily assault from radical Islam. So to me, if we want to really live our values and really want to defend what is important to us as Americans, we've got to start with this vulnerable frontline ally. Defending Israel is standing up for our values in a very real and concrete way.
And so that's why, personally, honestly, that's the reason why you personally, you have two organizations here, the Maccabee Task Force and Christians United for Israel. That's a huge commitment, given, again, your resume, David. So you obviously have a vested interest in this.
Yeah. No, look, to me, this is very real, very personal. I'm deeply connected to Israel. And to me, it is a cause that is underserved, which is funny. I think people perceive Israel, the Israel lobby, as this massive political force, and that Israel has plenty of defenders. That's not what I see, especially when you look at college campuses, especially when you look at our young people. I think you see a lot of myths and misperceptions about Israel. I think the Israel's enemies have done a fantastic job of infiltrating and of spreading what they call their narrative. Their narrative about Israel includes a heck of a lot of lies about Israel. So we need not to, we can't relax, we can't take it easy, we can't say Israel's fine. I think now is the time when people who care about these issues really need to stand up and speak out for Israel. And to me, this is just every day is a reminder of how vulnerable Israel is, and every day is a reminder of how important it is to speak out on her behalf.
Well, of course, in your book, Reclaiming Israel's History, Roots, Rights, and the Struggle for Peace, you've given some concrete reasons, arguments for why this media narrative and university college narrative is just wrong. And I agree with you, David. I think I've told you I've been to Israel 3 times. Of course, I have a prejudice. I'm a follower of Jesus, and Israel has always been at the center of that story. But I have never been one that says that Israel, no matter what they do, who they are, Israel, right or wrong, I don't think you are either. But there are historical reasons and current reasons why people need to know that are being distorted by the left and by the media. So let's talk about that. You know, one of the biggest ones we alluded to already is this whole business that Israel are, they're occupying this territory. It belonged to Palestinians, after all. It's occupied now by the Jews. They're interlopers. What do you have to say about that?
So, yeah, first of all, I'm with you, Sandy. Israel, it's a government of men. It's fallible. They make mistakes. And it's fair game to criticize Israel when Israel makes mistakes. The problem isn't that people think Israel is perfect, and we need to go ahead and to correct that impression. The problem is that Israel is being demonized and delegitimized. And so we need to go in and really say, wait a minute, imperfect though it may be, Israel is fundamentally moral, and Israel is fundamentally holding up our values in a very difficult neighborhood. The real front line of attack now, the real narrative that's gaining speed now is what you referenced, that Israel is an occupier, Israel is an oppressor, Israel is an obstacle to peace. And so it's critical to go back to the beginning and to remind people that that's simply not the case, that the Jewish people have a 3-millennia-old connection to the land of Israel. They never left the land of Israel, even after the Romans did their worst and destroyed Jerusalem and exiled hundreds of thousands and killed hundreds of thousands. A massive Jewish population remained and has always been in the land of Israel. Then when the modern Zionists return in the latest wave of Jewish immigration, there have been repeated waves of Jewish return to the Jewish homeland in Israel. But the most recent wave of return to the Jewish homeland in Israel occurred with the modern Zionist movement in the late 1800s. And ever since Jews returned to their homeland, they have gone out of their way to respect the human rights of the Arabs living there and the civil rights of the Arabs living there. And then when the Arabs living there developed a national consciousness, when they started to say we're Arabs or we're Palestinians, the Israelis went out of their way to recognize that and to compromise. People think If Israel allowed the Palestinians to have a state of their own tomorrow, there would be peace in the Middle East. And so I point out in the book, and I try to point out whenever I speak, Israel's actually offered the Palestinians a state of their own on five separate occasions: 1937, 1947, 1967, 2000, and 2008. Each time the Palestinians turned it down. So it makes you realize that the problem here might not be that Israel isn't seeking peace and offering peace. The problem seems to lay elsewhere in the fact that the Palestinians reject peace and seem more interested in destroying the Jewish state.
David, back to the point of the Jews never leaving the land that God gave them in the Bible. They never totally left. They were exiled. They had to go to Jerusalem. The Romans, of course, did terrible things to the Jewish people. They were dispersed, but you say that they did not ever all leave. So these claims that the land itself does not belong to them are no other. What other people? I guess maybe the Egyptians. There are other people groups who have laid thousands of years claim to land, but not many, right? Civilizations change names and languages and cultures, but this is one that has not done that, right?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. You know, the Romans, people living in Rome today are not much connected to the Romans of Roman times. Same for the modern Greeks. There have been many changes. It's really civilizations like the Chinese and like the Jews are you know, the first two that come to mind that have maintained the same language and the same culture and living in the same land. Now, in the Jewish case, there was an exile. While the Jews always maintained a presence in the land of Israel, while Jews always returned to the land of Israel whenever conditions would permit, there was an exile. A large part of the Jewish people lived outside, lived in Europe, lived in Arab countries, and returned to the land when they could. And the most recent opportunity to return was with the creation of the State of Israel in 1948. But the question is, you know, because you were exiled, because you were living outside of your land, do you lose your claim to it? And I don't think there's a statute of limitations on being indigenous. I don't think you lose your claim. And so when you look at the history and you see the way Jews clung to this land and always returned to it whenever they could, and whenever they could, made the deserts bloom, you know, developed businesses, developed agriculture, you see a story of a people tied to a land, and this tie can't be denied.
Well, David,
then the question becomes, how did they behave towards others in the land? And there, the record of Israel towards the Arab residents of what was called Palestine is one that I find quite compelling.
Well, we just have
every
a minute.
Opportunity.
Let's talk a minute about that term Palestine, because that's really interesting. You point out in your book that the Romans actually coined that term. Explain.
So one of the strategies used against the Jews from Roman times until yesterday has been to deny and sever the connection between the Jewish people and the land of Israel. This land under Roman times was called Judea. Judea meaning land of the Jews. That's where the word Jew comes from, Judea. So when the Romans got tired of the Jews rebelling against them, they said, okay, we're gonna kill a bunch of you, we're gonna exile a bunch of you, and we're gonna deny the connection your people has to this land by changing the name of this land from Judea to Palestine. And then Palestine was.
I'm going to interrupt you because let's pick up with that thought, because this is really an important. It's maybe, you know, in the light of all the things you've written, may not seem so important, but I think it is an important point to make. David Brog is my guest. His book is Saving Israel from the Lies of the Left. There's so much to this book, and we're going to talk about it when we return. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
Yeah. Israel and the Arab world went to war today for the third time in 20 years. After 2 weeks of crisis and of stalemate in the United Nations, the frustrations on both sides boiled over into a shooting war during the early hours of this morning. It began with air raids and artillery action, and by tonight, thousands of ground troops were engaged in fighting in the Sinai Peninsula, the same ground where Israel and Egypt fought their 100-hour war 11 years ago. While the fighting grew more intense during the day, the major powers were trying to work out a ceasefire through the United Nations. And though the U.S. and the Soviet Union were in agreement on the desirability of an immediate truce, negotiations bogged down over terms. The U.S. wants a ceasefire, period, while Moscow wants troop withdrawals to positions prior to the outbreak of today's hostilities. The U.S. says that if this is the case, then both sides should return to positions they held before the Egyptians occupied Sharm el-Sheikh, overlooking the Strait of Tehran at the entrance to the Gulf of Aqaba. While they bargained privately in the United Nations and outside it, each of the major powers announced public positions in the dispute. The U.S. State Department called for a ceasefire through the United Nations and announced that because each side blames the other for the outbreak, the U.S. is taking a position of neutrality. But Moscow branded Israel the aggressor and demanded that it stop all military action unconditionally. Meanwhile, the Arab world joined together. Egypt, Syria, Jordan, Lebanon, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, even Algeria joined against Israel.
All right, that was the voice of Mike Wallace, the dad of Chris Wallace. For some of you who don't remember him, he was just a fixture in our homes before he died. And that, of course, is a report about the 67 war. And it is that war that is often referred to when they talk about the borders of Israel. In fact, President Obama kept saying they needed to go back to the 67, prior to the 67 war, the borders. And you heard Mike Wallace discuss that in that clip. David Braga is my guest, again, the executive director of the Maccabee Task Force and the founding executive director of Christians United for Israel. His new book is Reclaiming Israel's History, Roots, Rights, and the Struggle for Peace. It's just out this week, so you're hearing about this for the first time, and David is with us by phone. All right, so David, let's go back to the notion or the fact that the Romans actually coined the term Palestine. And then let's talk about the land dispute that I just mentioned of the 67-day war, the 67 conflict. And let's pick it up there.
Yeah, sure. So you're saying the Romans were tired of these Jewish rebellions, and they said let's exile a lot of these Jews and let's sever their connection to the land by changing the name of the land from Judea to Palestine. They called it. They took the name of the traditional enemy of the Jews in the Bible, the Philistines, who lived on the coast. And so this was really, to put salt in the wound. Not only are we taking away the name Judea, we're giving the land you lived in the name of your enemy, the Philistines, Palestine. That was in Roman times. But this desire to delegitimize Israel by denying the Jewish connection to the land of Israel, it lives on until today. The Palestinian Authority often denies there's any Jewish connection to the land of Israel. In fact, Yasser Arafat at Camp David, when they were trying to negotiate peace back in 2000, said to President Bill Clinton, there was never a Jewish temple in Jerusalem. Well, if there was never a Jewish temple in Jerusalem, so where exactly did Jesus pray and teach?
And what exactly,
the connection.
What exactly is that we go when we go to Jerusalem and we see with the wall? What is that?
Right.
Yeah.
But facts become irrelevant in this narrative that's used against Israel. And in this narrative that's used against Israel, the Jews have no connection. They have no rights to be there. They're European interlopers. Nice narrative, but a lot of lies.
There's a story that you mentioned in here, and I don't know what it is, actually. It's an untold story. How the leader of the Palestine's Arabs collaborated with the Nazis to murder Jews in Europe. That wasn't the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, was it?
It sure was.
Okay, so tell us
that. The Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, the first leader of the Palestinian Arabs, sort of when they began to view themselves as a separate people, he didn't like the fact that Jews were immigrating to Israel. He didn't like the fact that Jews were returning to their homeland. Many Arabs did. Many Arabs said, great, they're bringing economic opportunity with them. Our standard of living is improving. They're bringing health care with them. They're curing our diseases. Some Arabs didn't like it. They said, no, this is ours. We don't want to share it with anyone. The Mufti so disliked Jewish immigration that during World War II, he went to live in Berlin, where he not only was a chief propagandist for Hitler in Arabic, he was on the radio every day in Arabic defending Hitler and the Nazis, but he actually helped Hitler recruit divisions and battalions of Muslims to help in the war effort. And he was very clear with the Nazis that he wanted to bring the final solution to Jerusalem when the Nazis conquered Jerusalem. He wanted to kill off the Jews of Europe before they could come to Israel, and then he wanted to kill the Jews that had already made it to Israel. Thank God, the Nazis never did conquer Jerusalem. The Allies stopped them in North Africa before they could get there. And thank God, ultimately, the Nazis were defeated. But the Mufti of Jerusalem has a very clear record, and he set a very clear precedent of not recognizing Jewish rights, but trying to instead kill the Jews.
That's often now in the headlines today. On this show, I often talk about the Red-Green Axis and trace it back to the Grand Mufti, David, because of the cooperation, historic cooperation between the Muslims and groups like the Nazis. So I'm curious to know, though, in Jerusalem of that day, like during the war, during World War II, was Jerusalem occupied? I mean, who controlled it? It wasn't divided like it is now, or was it?
So what we now call Israel and the West Bank was for three centuries under the rule of the Ottoman Empire. It was ruled from Istanbul and part of the Ottoman Empire. In 1917, towards the end of World War I, Britain conquered it. And the League of Nations gave Britain what was called a mandate to rule the land for a period of time. And the idea of the mandate was, you're going to rule this land until the people of this land are ready for independence. So in 1917, Britain conquered. They were given a mandate, and they ruled what was called the British Mandate for Palestine until 1947. And in 1947, that's when the UN came in and said, hey, you know, you got Arabs and Jews living in this land. Each of them wants to rule it. Why don't we divide it? And it was one of the first times a two-state solution was proposed. They offered the Jews a land in half of Palestine, the Arabs a country in the other half. The Jews said yes and danced in the streets. The Arabs said no and attacked the Jews. But the history of Jews in this land goes back well beyond the Ottomans, during the Ottomans, during the British. And what we see in British rule was the first time that an effort was made to compromise. And it began this pattern of the Jews saying, okay, we'll compromise, we'll split, we'll give the Arabs a state here too, and the Arabs saying, no, we don't want a state, we want your state not to exist.
The Arabs that lived in Palestine did not call themselves Palestinians until that 67 war, I don't think. And so they called themselves other things, like Jordanians. I don't know, maybe Jordan wasn't even a country then. I don't know what they called themselves, but whatever their native country was, that's how they referred to themselves. But then they began to embrace the title Palestinian. But it's not really an Arab country in the truest sense. I mean, the name is not, as you've described.
Yeah, so during the British mandate for Palestine, you know, really from 1917 on, it was the first time that the Arabs living in what was called Palestine were divided from Arabs living in Syria or Egypt. You know, under the Ottoman Empire, they were all under Ottoman rule. This is the first time they were divided. And some Arabs, as early as the 1920s, some Arabs in Palestine started to say, our new identity has to be as Palestinians. We're Arabs living in the British Mandate for Palestine. Our new identity is as Palestinian Arabs. But there were lots of other competing identities. A lot of the Arabs living in Palestine were what they called pan-Arabs. They saw themselves as Arab citizens of a vast Arab land stretching from Morocco to Iraq. They didn't embrace this border that was imposed by the League of Nations. They didn't see themselves as Palestinians, but Arabs. Others started to identify with that large Arab country to their east, Jordan, especially after Jordan conquered the West Bank in 1948. They started to say, okay, our new identity is as Jordanians. Initially, they felt they were part of Syria. They identified themselves as southern Syrians. So what you see from the birth of the British Mandate in the early 1920s until 1967 is a number of identities competing for the loyalties of the Arabs living in what was the British Mandate for Palestine. Pan-Arab, Jordanian, Southern Syrian, Palestinian. It was only after the 67 war, only after Israel took the West Bank from Jordan in a defensive war, I'd add, and these Arabs found themselves under Israeli rule, that they abandoned this identity as Jordanians. They abandoned this identity as pan-Arabs. And they started to really embrace the idea that they were a separate people, a Palestinian people that needed their own separate Palestinian state.
You know, I don't know if this is related, but it brings to mind the word that Barack Obama continually used, and John Kerry also, to describe the Arab region, ISIL, the Islamic State of the Levant. Is that in any way descriptive of how the Arabs saw their land base before this started being divided up after the Ottoman Empire was defeated? I may be asking you a question you don't know the answer to, but I'm asking.
No, this idea of the calling the territory that includes present day Israel and Jordan and the West Bank and Syria by a larger name, the Levant, or in Arabic al-Shams, that goes back. So again, everyone living in this area for hundreds of years saw themselves as Ottoman subjects. If you ask them, who are you? They'd say, well, I'm an Ottoman, I'm a Muslim, I'm a member of this clan or this village. That was their identity. After the League of Nations gave Britain the mandate for Palestine, and the mandate really came into effect in the early 1920s, it was the first time this border was imposed on what the Muslims and the Arabs always viewed as a larger territory within the Ottoman Empire. The first time the idea of Syria, al-Shams, the Levant, was divided. But just because the League of Nations drew some borders there doesn't mean all the Arabs initially accepted it and said, okay, you drew a border, so I guess my identity is no longer as a Syrian, it's no longer as an Arab, my identity is a Palestinian. That process took decades. And what's often done is the present fact that the Palestinians see themselves as a separate people that want their own land, it's often projected back into the past. And people say, oh, the Jews, when they started building their Jewish state in the late 1800s, they should have known that there was a Palestinian people, and they should have compromised with this Palestinian people. Well, it's projecting back into the past something that didn't exist back then. So at each stage of their return to their land, the Jews said, okay, there are Arabs living here, and we need to recognize their human rights, we need to respect their civil rights, but they couldn't predict what their national rights would look like. So each step of the way, as these national claims and identities shifted, Israel did its best to accommodate them. And in fact, after 1967, when the Palestinians started saying that they were a separate Palestinian people, the Israelis accommodated even that. But you hear the way this history is taught on college campuses, of how the Jews came and took the land of the Palestinians and took away the country of the Palestinians, and you realize that the people are simply misreading their history. They probably just don't know their history. That people is such a new concept, and that country never existed.
Yes, you know, and I think one other, just a side, fascinating story about Israel to me, David, is that they had to reinvent a spoken language. Hebrew was written, they'd left the land, Hebrew was no longer spoken, and so starting in 48, they started creating the spoken language of Hebrew, so that's kind of an interesting thing, that a whole people would regenerate a written language. And that's why we have the sounds that we have today of the Israelis speaking Hebrew. I think that's fascinating.
It's actually an amazing story. I mean, Hebrew was for centuries a language of the Bible. It was a language of scholarship. It was a language of ritual. But this spirit that brought so many Jews back to the land of Israel, the Zionist movement in the late 1800s, it was a national liberation movement. It was a movement for national liberation and national renewal, where Jews who had lived as a persecuted minority in Arab countries and in Europe decided they were tired of being a persecuted minority in someone else's country. They wanted to go back to their country, take control of their lives, and regain their independence. And they went that additional step to say, in our country, we don't want to speak someone else's language. We want to speak our own language. We want to revive the Hebrew tongue. it's really a beautiful thing and a beautiful idea. And what's amazing is they actually did it. You know, even Theodor Herzl, the father of modern Zionism, the guy who first envisioned this Jewish return and this Jewish independence, he thought that the Jews would go back to their land in Israel and speak German. He just had no idea that it was possible to recreate and revitalize this ancient Hebrew tongue, and that people would actually make it their day-to-day language. So in many ways, Israel is a modern miracle.
It is a modern miracle, and we're going to talk more about it. In fact, we'll come up into next we speak in just a minute. Let's come into current contemporary times about the anti-Semitism, the treatment of the Israelis by the last president, contrasted with the current president, and other things related to Israel's history. Reclaiming Israel's History is the book. My guest is David Brog. This is Sandy Rios in the Morning, back right after this.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the Morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Facing me, right up there in the gallery, overlooking all of us in this august chamber, is the image of Moses. Moses led our people from slavery to the gates of the Promised Land. And before the people of Israel entered the land of Israel, Moses gave us a message that has steeled our resolve for thousands of years. I leave you with his message today. Chizku v'imtzu, al tiru ve'al ta'artzu mipnehem. Be strong and resolute, neither fear nor dread them. My friends, may Israel and America always stand together, strong and resolute. May we neither fear nor dread the challenges ahead. May we face the future with confidence, strength, and hope. May God bless the state of Israel, and may God bless the United States of America.
All right, that was Benjamin Netanyahu, current Prime Minister of Israel. Of course, you recognize his voice, I think. He was speaking to a joint session of Congress. I believe he was invited by the Congress, a part outside of the purview of the president at the time, which was Barack Obama, and gave just a stunning speech, which brings us into Israel's future. Reclaiming Israel's History is the book, and David Brog is the author. David has a tremendous interest in this topic. He's really dedicated his life to this. The book is excellent, by the way, and has some great recommendations. Dennis Prager, Pastor John Hagee, and Glenn Beck, all three of them, and more. But just so you know, and it just came out this week, so it's a brand new piece, and it's coming at a very needed time when the anti-Semitism that we are hearing, it's creeping into Europe. You know, Jews are leaving France and by the droves because it's becoming so unsafe, but it's happening here in America, too, on college campuses. And so I think I'm guessing that this is David's attempt to educate the American people and push this back while we still can. David, if you were to describe the relationship between Israel and President Obama, I have my own thoughts about this, but just how bad was it from your perspective?
Well, I think in President Obama, we had a president who fundamentally misunderstood the world, and because of that, I don't know the man's motives. I got to tell you. I disagree with a lot of my friends think he somehow wanted to do harm to Israel or America. I don't know. I think he may well have wanted to do good for Israel and America. But like so many progressives, and by the way, I went to law school with Barack Obama. We were in the same class at law school. I know the environment in which he was educated. And like so many progressives, I just think he fundamentally misunderstood the world. And he didn't recognize the existence of evil in the world. And because of that, he ended up in his 8 years in office making the world a far more dangerous place, both for America and for Israel. His biggest mistake, of course, was his deal with Iran. He has emboldened and strengthened and enriched one of the, one of what George W. Bush rightly called, controversially called, the axis of evil. But Iran is the number one state sponsor of terrorism in the world. What other adjective do you use for a country that through its puppet Hezbollah blew up a Jewish community center in Buenos Aires? I mean, they're not just trying to destroy Israel. They blew up a Jewish community center in Buenos Aires and have tried to attack Americans at every opportunity they have. They blew up our embassy in Beirut. They blew up our Marines barracks in Beirut. This was Iran through its puppet Hezbollah. So you try to make the world a safer place for Israel and America by emboldening them, by recognizing them, by enriching them, by welcoming them back into the family of nations. So that is the tip of a long list of mistakes President Obama made that had the result of making this world so dangerous. I fear that both Israelis and Americans will pay a price in blood for President Obama's naivete.
Yeah, David, I'm not so generous as you. I have to confess right up front here. When it came to my attention that the Obama administration was withholding, support, military support, withholding parts for a certain war machinery, et cetera, there were some intentional things that I think were tremendously harmful to Israel that I don't lay at the feet of innocence or naivety, but we don't have to we don't have to agree on that. The bottom line is the bottom line. What happened with Israel made Israel much less safe, and Israel really suffered under his bad judgment, whether it's intentional or unintentional. In fact,
the only point I'd want to make, Sandy, is if you think it was just Obama, you might make the mistake of thinking that the danger is over. The danger is
no, bad. No. Yes,
it
you're
has
right.
Not. Yeah. This is common to the progressive wing of the Democratic Party,
yes.
And I fear we're going to see a lot more of this.
I totally agree with you. And as always with the left, there are a lot of innocent, good, well-meaning people who go along for the ride, led by people who are not so innocent and not so well-meaning. And I do think that's certainly the case on Israel, too.
Yes.
But let's talk about, you mentioned this, you alluded to it, but let's talk about it. When I was in Israel the last time, I went on a briefing, and I was with military, primarily military leaders, and I was with the Flying Camels, this brigade that goes in and drops bombs strategically in the Arab territory, and just the extraordinary measures they went to warn people so that they wouldn't be civilians would not be harmed was amazing. But you write about that, so let me let you explain how far they go to protect Arab civilians.
Well, it's an amazing thing, and of course Israel's criticized for this. So Hamas, a terrorist group that controls Gaza, Hamas's charter says on the first line, Israel will exist until Islam will obliterate it. So they're not shy about their goal. Hamas fires missiles into Israel by the thousands. By the thousands. Until Israel decides that it has to do what any country would do after one missile, not thousands of missiles. Israel decides it must go in and stop the missile fire. Here's the problem. Hamas fires its missiles from civilian areas, and it stores its missiles in civilian areas. So Israel's confronted with this challenge. How do we defend our citizens without harming Palestinian civilians? Because Hamas is trying its best to blend in and be part of these civilian areas so that when Israel does strike, it will harm civilians, and they use civilian casualties as part of their PR war against Israel. So here's what Israel does. First of all, before attacking any neighborhood in Gaza, it leaflets, it blankets the neighborhood in leaflets that say, hey, we're coming in, we're going to be doing some military strikes in this neighborhood, please leave, and it provides safe passage routes. If you take the safe passage route during the times allotted, you'll be fine. It will take you out of danger. So first it comes in with leaflets. But that's not enough. Once they pinpoint a building in a neighborhood that is storing missiles or missiles are being fired from that building, Israel actually calls every resident of the building or texts, phone calls to cell phones or text messages, often both, saying, we're going to strike your building. Please leave. Please get out of there. We don't want to harm you. We just have to take out these missiles. So what happened is Palestinians living in Gaza learned that Israel is so careful, so much doesn't want to harm civilians, that if they know civilians are in these buildings, despite the warnings, Israel won't fire on them. So civilians living in these buildings would often go up to the roofs, often at gunpoint. Often Hamas would force them onto the roofs. Israeli fighter pilots would see civilians on the roof, and they would divert their missiles. They had missiles worth tens of thousands of dollars, hundreds of thousands of dollars. The minute they saw civilians on the roof, they divert them to uninhabited areas. Then Israel had to develop a third technique: leaflets, phone calls, text, and then finally, they developed a method called knocking on the roof. If they see these civilians on the roof, they developed a harmless bomb they can drop on the ceiling of the roof that makes a very loud and frightening noise but doesn't hurt anybody. They drop that on the roof. That usually causes the civilians to leave. They count. We saw eight civilians on the roof. We just saw eight people leave the building. Now we can strike. And so it goes through all of these steps in order to protect civilians. But, you know, in the process, Israel gives up something kind of vital in war. They completely give up the element of surprise. They announce over and over and over again, we're coming, and they allow time for civilians to flee. So during that time, the terrorists also tend to flee, and they also tend to flee with a lot of the very weapons Israel was trying to take out. That means Israel's efforts to defend its citizens will suffer. That means missiles that Israel could have destroyed will end up landing on Israeli citizens. But Israel takes that risk. Israel suffers those blows because Israel's trying its best to live up to the highest of Judeo-Christian values that values every innocent life. Israel does that. Israel suffers for that. Israelis die because of Israel's effort to protect innocent Palestinian civilians. Yet all people read about in the newspaper is how Israel is some sort of monster. Israel is some sort of aggressor. They have it exactly backwards. And when you know the reality, it's maddening.
Yeah, David, I can attest to everything you're saying. I could not believe in the briefings what they told, the extraordinary measures they go to not kill civilians is just amazing, and still they get blamed.
Hamas fires its missiles at civilian areas. They're trying to strike civilians in cities. Fire their missiles from civilian areas in Gaza so that that's where Israel will respond.
And put their civilians on the roof, as you described, to try to, to dissuade. And if there's anything that happens, then they're in harm's way. It is really, how in the world do you fight a people who don't value human life? This is the problem we face now.
You have Hamas trying to target civilians. You have Israel doing everything humanly possible to spare civilians, yet somehow Israel is the monster.
All right, so David, we must move to this. We have a new president, President Donald Trump, who initially in his campaign, I felt, was a little tepid or coy about his feelings about Israel, but he seems to have a sort of changed into a real, at least in my words, like a champion, at least a would-be champion of Israel. How do you see it?
Well, I think he's a work in progress. So he was a little coy at first. Then he came out with some profoundly pro-Israel statements and sentiments. But now we're seeing some of that caution or coyness return. So he said on the campaign trail he'd move the embassy to Israel's capital, Jerusalem. He hasn't done that yet. He started off campaigning saying he wants to do the ultimate real estate deal between Israel and the Palestinians. Then he engaged in more clearly pro-Israel rhetoric. Now he's back to talking about the real estate deal. So look, I think President Trump is going to be a very pro-Israel president. I think his instincts are pro-Israel. His statements are pro-Israel. His appointments have been pro-Israel. But I also know that when presidents get to Washington, they start getting a lot of advice. And a lot of it isn't very good. And so I do think those of us who love Israel need to weigh in and need to make sure he's hearing from us as well, so that he'll continue to do those things he said he'd do on the campaign trail and that he'll live up to his potential to be a truly pro-Israel president.
As you reflect on what's happening on college and university campuses, becoming so anti-Semitic, so that even professors, people are even afraid, you know, to express pro-Israeli views, how do you see that being reconciled? And I guess, first of all, before that, I think this is emanating from the heightened awareness and sensitivity to Islam here in this country and to the influx of Muslims who practice Islam who hate Israel. I think that's part of it, but I think it's in cooperation with the left that you described earlier How do you see it?
Yeah. I mean, look, you know, first of all, you know, there are Muslim immigrants to this country, and there are Palestinian Muslims who are wonderful, peace-loving people, just want to raise their families and really want to live out a love and a compassion and a hospitality that I find admirable. But there is this other interpretation of Islam, which is not a small minority, this radical Islam, that really justifies murder in the name of the faith and really sees the fact that there's Jewish sovereignty in the Middle East and what they view as purely Arab territory as a crime that must be reversed, and who see the lives of non-Muslims as less valuable and lives they can sacrifice for the sake of their faith.
David, we're going to have to do another day in order to get all of this. And I just would say that if you want more information, this is a great book with lots of wonderful, beautiful quotes that we didn't even get to, with the history of Israel that you will enjoy, Reclaiming Israel's History, Roots, Rights, and the Struggle for Peace. David Brog, thank you. It's so nice to have this time with you, and I wish you all the best with this great book.
Thank you, Sandy. Really appreciate it.
All right. This has been Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.